In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Joshua Hammer. He works for Newsweek magazine and for several years now has been writing about the conflict in the Middle East. He first went to work at Newsweek as a staff writer in 1988. In 92, he moved to Nairobi, and he spent the next 4 years as Newsweek's Africa bureau chief. After that, he worked heading up the bureaus in South America, Los Angeles, and Berlin before he moved to Jerusalem in January of 2001. He's also contributed to other publications, including Esquire, New Republic, Rolling Stone, and Mother Jones. He's the author of a new book that details some of the experiences that he had and some of the reporting that he has done. It's titled A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place, and it's published by the Free Press. And roughly speaking, talks about some of the events in between the fall of 2000, when what has been called the Second Intifada began, and the spring of 2002, and culminates with his account of the siege of the church there in Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity, that is marked as the place where Jesus was born. We'll be talking with him here in the next hour, and questions, of course, are welcome. All we ask of people who call in is that they're brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois or Indiana. Also, if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, you may also use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. I guess I should say if you're listening on the Internet and you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Otherwise, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Mr. Hammer, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure. Thanks, Dave.
You had some experience, certainly before you went to Israel, had some experience as a foreign correspondent, and I'm sure covering conflict in Africa. But I guess I wonder whether you feel that any of that really prepared you for Israel and that conflict when you went there.
Well, certainly I was used to combat situations and being under fire, having been in Liberia, Somalia, Rwanda, even in South America somewhat, and Kosovo, the Balkans. But I wasn't really prepared for the complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict mastering all of the details and being kind of yo-yoing back and forth between the Palestinian narrative and the Israeli narrative, and this sort of parsing of hairs and the infinitesimal details that are squabbled over and contested, that really is impossible to grasp. Even in a lifetime.
Yeah. Well, that I'm sure that is the challenge because, as you say, there are a variety of perspectives. There is a long history which is contested. As a reporter, I'm sure that no matter what you write, someone is going to say, well, you're wrong about this. You got that wrong. And then we'll tell you just exactly what it should be, reflecting whatever their particular point of view or agenda is.
No, that's the problem with being one of the I wouldn't call it necessarily a problem, but one of the aspects of being a journalist in the Middle East is that you're in a fishbowl, and passions are incredibly high over this relatively tiny patch of territory with not so many people in it, arouses interest and passion and hostility all around the world. So everything that you say is interpreted and dissected, and certainly everything you say goes out on the internet, goes out on the internet. Of course, I write for Newsweek, so that carries an additional sense of scrutiny, and because it's mainstream and it's read by so many people to begin with, so it just reverberates down and down, and I never, almost every piece I write provokes some sort of response. It's invariable, and either it's anger from the left or anger from the right, anger from the Palestinian camp, anger from the pro-Sharon camp, from the Peace Now camp. My philosophy is if you get everybody across the board angry at you at one time or another, then you know you're doing a good job.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that journalists have tried to do in dealing with the story, given the fact that it is complex, is to try to find a manageable kind of story, something that they can tell that will allow them to explore the bigger themes. And it seems that that's in choosing to write about Bethlehem, that seems that that's what that was your tactic and your approach to try to do that.
Exactly. I wanted to do, as I say in the introduction to the book, a biography of a place, to pick one town, and I was and learn everything I could about it and humanize the characters and use it as a microcosm for what was going on around during this whole tumultuous period. And Bethlehem, for various reasons, just seemed to fit the bill perfectly.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit more about Bethlehem. What kind of a place is it?
It's about 5 miles south of Jerusalem, much closer to Jerusalem than I... one of the things that I was unprepared for was how close things are in the Middle East, and especially this area. So, you leave Jerusalem, you drive down the main highway, you cross a checkpoint, you're suddenly in a different world, within 10 minutes. So Bethlehem is about 5 miles south of Jerusalem, center of Jerusalem. It's a hilly town. It's up in the Judean Hills, just like Jerusalem. Landscape is similar. Very arid place. Very haphazard in its construction. Just sort of scattered over the hills, or just hundreds and thousands of stone houses, blocky houses, typical Arab constructions. And then in the very center of the city, the epicenter of the city consists of the old town, originally built in the biblical times, rebuilt in the Byzantine era and rebuilt again in the Crusader era. And the old city abuts the church, what's called Manger Square, and the Church of the Nativity, this kind of fortress-like complex that really has defined Bethlehem and been the heart of the city for 1,500 years. Of course, it was built over the manger, the grotto, where Christians say that Jesus was born. So it's a complex, fascinating place, and has a lot of different population groups and a lot of friction, even in normal times.
Hmm. You went there at right around the time of the beginning of what now some people would say is called the Second Intifada, which began in the fall of 2000. And, in other interviews, I think I've used this as a jumping-off point because I have never quite been able to understand completely what happened. And I think about the fact that just a matter of days before this happened, before Ariel Sharon made his ill-fated visit to the Temple Mount, we were reading stories about just, in fact, how good things were and how promising things were. And one of the things that I remember is reading a story about how Yasser Arafat had gone to dinner at the home of the previous prime minister, Ehud Barak, and it was described as being one of the best meetings the man had ever had. And then in a matter of days, a handful of days, things completely fell apart, and then we saw the beginning of some of the worst violence in a long, long time. And I guess I had never quite been able to understand how things went from when it appeared, and maybe that was the issue, it appeared on the surface that things were there was reason to be optimistic, and in such a short period of time, things got so bad.
Well, I think you have to look at Camp David. Let's use Camp David as a starting point, because this was viewed by Israelis and Palestinians as the opportunity for a final settlement. Ehud Barak was looking for some sweeping concessions that he thought would it was basically a take it or leave it offer that he figured would solve the problem forever. Two states living side by side, peace and harmony, economic prosperity. Arafat didn't like the offer. He didn't make a counter offer, despite Bill Clinton's best efforts to bring these two sides together. Camp David collapsed. When Camp David ended in July 2000 without an agreement, it really was quite a shock to both sides, and I think confirmed suspicions on both sides of the worst intentions of the other. The Palestinians believe that the Israelis were not serious because they accepted Arafat's version of events, that the offer was unacceptable and he had to turn it down. The Israelis saw the Palestinians as ultimately not really interested in peace and wanting to drive the Jews to the sea as so many Palestinians had said publicly and privately. And so you had this incredible tension already, but although you talk about this meeting between Arafat and Barak, it was cordial. I think there was this attempt, even after Camp David, to salvage things, find another way. But still, it was this tremendous sense of disappointment and bitterness and anger, and it really required a spark to set it off. And the spark, of course, was Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount on September 29th, 2000.
Just this past summer, I had an opportunity to talk with an Israeli journalist who'd written a book about what was happening at this very time and who apparently had some access to the people who were involved in the negotiations for the Israelis and the Palestinians on both sides, talking about the fact that at that point, when things seemed to have broken down at Camp David, the door hadn't completely been closed. There was the idea that the talks were supposed to continue, and that, in fact, what I think one of the things that this journalist concluded was that the Clinton administration really dropped the ball by turning away from the issue for a period of months. And so it wasn't really until the beginning of the next year did they actively really get involved in there again. And the suggestion was that if indeed the administration had again pushed the two sides to get back to talking, that maybe something could have been worked out, that it wasn't necessarily the end when it looked as it looked.
Might have been the case. I know for a fact that that several of the the Camp David participants were meeting and walking around Jerusalem, actually walking the streets in those weeks after the collapse of the talks in July and August, and saying, you know, well, we can solve this problem. We have this big disagreement over the division of Jerusalem. For instance, this is one thorny problem that we have to address. But why, you know, and they would walk the streets and say, this street could be yours, this street could be ours. I mean, literally trying to redraw the map as one sort of a last-ditch effort to get around these problems that had not been resolved at Camp David. I also know that Ariel Sharon's planned trip, you know, he telegraphed this well in advance. I mean, he made his intentions known. He was at the time involved in a political battle with Netanyahu for the leadership of the Likud party. And the generally accepted interpretation of that trip was that it was a political move to assert Israeli dominance over this sacred patch of a very disputed land and say that this belongs to Israel. We have sovereignty. We will not give up sovereignty. It was a message that the right wing really would have been eager to hear, but it was very incendiary given the background, given the emotions of the time. And there was a desperate attempt by Arafat and others in the Palestinian Authority to stop this visit from Ariel Sharon. I mean, pleas to Ehud Barak, a last-minute phone call, I think even a personal meeting, saying, don't let it take place. You know, these people are angry. If he goes to the Temple Mount, Arafat said, I'll have an explosion on my hands, and I don't think I can control it. Now, this, of course, is one version. There's another version that says Arafat wanted this. He was looking for a pretext to start the whole thing, and that he couldn't have asked for anything better but Sharon's trip to the Temple. As soon as Sharon's trip became known, the wheels were set in motion for the Intifada. So who knows?
Yeah. Well, let me ask one further question, and then I have some callers who we'll get to. It seems that, you know, when people talk about why the process broke down at that point or why the more recent attempts, what has been called the roadmap, didn't succeed, that if you ask the leadership on the two sides, Israeli government and the Palestinian leadership, you ask, well, what happened? They will point to the other side and say, they did not fulfill the commitments they made. We don't even believe they intended to. Then if you ask people who maybe are not quite so partisan, then they might be likely to say, well, in fact, both sides are right. Neither of them did fulfill the commitments they made, and we wonder whether, in fact, they really intended to. And I guess whether can you say, in fact, that one or the other of the parties was more at fault, or would you say that, in fact, there was real failure to commit on both sides?
I think that there was real failure to commit on both sides, but I think that Mahmoud Abbas the then prime minister, managed to achieve a ceasefire with Hamas. Very difficult, extremely protracted negotiation, but it resulted in an agreement by the radicals that there would be no violence for 3 months, called a Hudna. Something extremely difficult for the Palestinian government to achieve because of the deep level of distrust of the Israelis. At that point, I don't think that the Israeli government never believed it. They began knocking it the second it took place. They refused to accept it. They said, this is not between us and the Palestinians. This is between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. It has nothing to do with us, and we don't buy it anyway. I mean, these people are just using this as an excuse to rearm. So even though there was a ceasefire in place, and there was no violence, in fact, the Israelis discounted it, and they continued the same sort of policies that have been going on for years, which is continue the incursions into the West Bank, continue targeting and killing militants, basically acting as if this ceasefire never existed. So to my mind, there was an opportunity lost there. Who knows if what would have happened after those 3 months had been up had Israel not made these continued its violence. But I believe that Israel undermined, possibly deliberately, Abbas's efforts at that particular, that very crucial, very sensitive point.
Let me introduce again our guest, and then we'll get some callers in here. We're talking with Joshua Hammer. He is Newsweek magazine's Jerusalem bureau chief. He has worked at Newsweek since 1988 and has also served as the magazine's bureau chief in Nairobi, Buenos Aires, Los Angeles, and Berlin, and has written a book about some of what he has seen, the events he's covered in the Middle East the past couple of years. The book is titled A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place, and it's published by the Free Press. And we have a number of callers. In fact, the lines are full. Again, we appreciate if people can be brief for us. We want to get in as many callers as we can. We start with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I have to be brief because I'm speaking from my work, but you started to get at some truth in your last statement about who is really at fault here. But you really ought to apply that to the entire situation and the entire history of this conflict, even though there is some fault on both sides. The vast amount of fault is on the Israeli side. I speak as a Jew in saying this, with somebody who once, believed the nonsense that we're told about Israel and Israel's good intentions and Israel's desire for peace. All throughout this process, especially through the Oslo process, Israel has acted in bad faith. We need less phony moral balance and more honesty about who is behind the destruction of the Palestinian people. They've been defeated. Now they're being destroyed, and it's heartbreaking. And there ought to any kind of balance is in this any kind of phony moral balance just denies what the reality of the situation is. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Hammer, you want to comment on that at all?
Well, it's certainly an unusual statement coming from an American Jew, because I, having traveled the country extensively over the last couple of weeks talking about this subject, I've found that there is an overwhelming support, American support, especially among the Jewish communities, for Israel. Sometimes I think unreflectingly and reflexively supporting Ariel Sharon, equating the Sharon policies with Israel. I would agree to some extent that, especially over the last 3 years, the policies of this Israeli government in particular, and Ariel Sharon's policies, have made the situation far, far worse, that he is he doesn't have any real interest in peace, that he is brutalizing the population there, that he has no desire for compromise, that his interests are not, that his intent is not sincere. On the other hand, I would also question Palestinian sincerity as well, but I do believe that Sharon has been very provocative, and that there have been repeated attempts, repeated opportunities along the way over the last 3 years when there could have been some sort of peace achieved and some sort of negotiation and progress made, that the Israeli government bears the responsibility for ruining. So to some extent, I agree with that, yeah, that caller.
Well, the thing is, too, though, all of those statements you just made about Ariel Sharon, mm-hmm, I'm sure have been made and maybe will be made about Yasser Arafat. You know, so you really have to, I guess I have a hard time understanding what exactly the motivation on the Palestinian side is, particularly for those people who continue to advocate and engage in violence.
I would agree that, I mean, I think that Arafat did make this calculated, risky decision several years ago, in late 2000, early 2001, that he would take the Intifada from a stone-throwing, firebombing rebellion, uprising, into something much more organized and violent, and using arms. And this was, in retrospect, a terrible decision that brought, you know, unfortunately, he was up against an adversary who was, you know, every bit as committed to using violence as he was. So then you had the sort of, you know, spiraling violence, and these two sides locked into this cycle they couldn't break out of. So, but I think that there were times when the violence could have been opportunities taken to change the course of this. And as I watched it, the breaking of ceasefires was invariably, almost always, initiated by the Israeli government. A really very provocative statement, but I've been there and I've watched this for. I think the roadmap is a perfect example of this. I mean, you had a Hudna, you could have given the Hudna an opportunity to work. I mean, granted, Hamas is not exactly an organization that merits trust. But you have to start somewhere. You have to take a leap of faith. They did get this 3-month ceasefire. Israel acted like it didn't exist, and it continued killing militants, guaranteeing that it was going to fail. And all I'm saying is that repeatedly in the last couple of years, it's been exactly that way. There have been times when Arafat has succeeded in getting ceasefires on the table, getting quiet, asking for, you know, in an attempt to see some changes on the ground. And the government of Ariel Sharon has always responded by killing more militants, by refusing to answer that ceasefire with something that would continue this, that would allow some sort of peace process to set in. It's almost as if there's a desire for this to fail.
Let's go next to Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm glad to hear some of what you said just there, but when you were talking about a lot of the undermining of any credibility to Arafat's stance, and as you say, in engineering ceasefires, it goes back to the myth of the good offer at Camp David. It wasn't a good offer. It was asking Arafat to run a Bantustan, and if it wasn't a matter of eschewing violence, it was a matter of turning violence on his own people. And basically, the U.S. and Israel want the Palestinians to have a civil war. They don't want to do the killing themselves. They want to have a Quisling government to do it for them. And anything less than that won't be acceptable, and that's a big problem, because there is no... support for that at all in the Palestinian population, and not even in the Palestinian Authority at this point. You didn't mention Taba, and there's also the myth.
Taba is a good point. Yeah, myth, you talk about that.
The myth of the good offer, and then the myth of the complete rejection, which was is undermined by Taba.
Yeah, Taba.
But actually, I have another problem with you, and that's your article in Mother Jones. I advise people to go to PAL Solidarity. This is for the Palestinian Solidarity Movement.org, and look at their action alert, Write to Mother Jones, about an article that you sort of hacked together, according to one of her colleagues.
Crap. Hacked together is absolute nonsense.
Well, one should take your denial in mind and then look at the evidence presented by a colleague of Rachel Corey's on this website, PAL Solidarity.
Fine, they're invited to, and they're invited to look at the response that I'm about to put online, and the idea that this was cobbled together International Solidarity Movement member accused me of doing from quote unquote right wing websites is thoroughly nonsensical.
Well, let's put the allegations of plagiarism aside. That we can discuss
we'll
that
deal with that
reference
too.
To Dershowitz and
we'll deal with that one too.
But let's talk about why you're going after a nonviolent movement in the way that you're going after.
Because it's not a nonviolent movement.
It certainly is.
It certainly is not. I don't like these people. I don't like these people, and I have been accused by both the Israelis and the Palestinians of being either too pro-Israeli or too pro. I'm on honestreporting.com's list of the ten journalists in the United States who are considered to be reflexively anti-Sharon and reflexively pro-Palestinian.
Well, you know
now,
what
I find it very interesting
com
that
is.
These people
it's
are accusing me of being reflexively pro-Israeli. The fact of the matter is that the International Solidarity Movement is a group of young people who have gone down there. Their only agenda is to express support for is blind support for the Palestinian cause, blind support for Yasser Arafat, blind support for the policy of suicide bombings. I asked this fellow on the air, why does your group, why does the ISM visit the families of suicide bombers, and why do you not visit the families of victims of suicide bombers in Israel? He could not come up with a response. He said that's somebody else's job. I'm sorry. Any group that showers all of its condolences and all of its commiseration on the families of Palestinian suicide bombers who have killed Israelis and makes no effort,
a mischaracterization.
To hear the other side is a group that I have no respect for. And
have you sat down with Aaron Shapiro of the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Excuse me?
International Solidarity Movement. Have you sat down and talked to him about this in your
No, opinion? I have talked at length. I have not talked to Mr. Shapiro. I have talked at length with a fellow who made these outlandish accusations, among which was, if you quote an Israeli spokesman responding to allegations, then that makes you in the camp of the Israeli spokesman you're quoting. Every time I quoted an Israeli spokesman answering allegations, an Israeli Defense Force spokesman, this person attacked me for buying the Israeli line. These people have never heard of anything of objective journalism. These people are so reflexively in the camp of violence, of armed resistance,
we're completely
blind to the suffering that Palestinian militants and suicide bombers have caused in Israel. At the same time, I am not denying that Israeli policy has caused tremendous suffering in the Palestinian territories, no question about it. I view both sides as being at fault here. The problem with these ISM people is that they are completely, unequivocally blind to the actions, to the suffering that is going on in Israel. Completely blind, and I've seen it with my own eyes. And I don't want to talk about the subject anymore.
All right, well, we're going to have to move on because we do have other callers. We're already past the midpoint. Let me again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Joshua Hammer. He is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine and has been there for a couple of years now writing about the Middle East. He's also been the Bureau Chief in some other places, including Nairobi, Buenos Aires, and Los Angeles and Berlin. He has a new book out that's about some of what he has seen, some of the reporting that he's done. It's titled A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place, the Free Press, the publisher. On again to another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, just to continue reviewing Camp David, some revised history. At Camp David, Israel virtually gave Yasser Arafat everything he was asking for at Camp David, short of Israel's committing suicide. Israel even granted Arafat part of Jerusalem. I mean, nobody thought they would do that. Not only does Arafat refuse to take yes for an answer, but he launches the suicide murder offensive as a result of being granted everything virtually that he was asking for. And how do you justify this launching of a suicide murder offensive? Well, Ariel Sharon visited the Temple Mount. I mean, gracious. I got it. You know, let's unrevise some history. Ariel Sharon cleared his visit to the Temple Mount, if that matters. And why shouldn't any religious person be able to peacefully visit the most holy, sacred site of his religion in his own country?
In the first place, Ariel Sharon is not a religious person. Ariel Sharon is a completely secular Jew who has not a religious bone in his body. In the second place, Ehud Barak was not in a position at that point to veto a visit. He simply did not have it in his power to do so. In the third place, Yes, Sharon was entitled to do that, but Sharon knew perfectly well the emotions that that visit would provoke. He knew the political context that he was visiting. He knew about the failure of Camp David. He knew that that move would almost, that moving across the Temple Mount, surrounded by his sunglass-wearing bodyguards, by dozens of Israeli troops, was an assertion of sovereignty, a brutal assertion of sovereignty that would almost certainly provoke the kind of violence, and ignite the kind of anger that you saw. This was a deliberate, provocative move by Sharon, and to say that it was some innocent expression of the rights of a religious person to view the Temple Mount is either disingenuous or naive.
May I ask you one more question?
Yes.
Please discuss the morality of recruiting children from kindergarten up, indoctrinating them in hatred. Your son, consider your son or your daughter, indoctrinating them to blow themselves
up. Did you just hear me 3 minutes ago talking about the I feel like when you talk about this issue, people just, you know, they hear what they want to hear. Did you hear me just dealing with this defender of the international solidarity movement and telling him that I thought this group was really crossing the line by its reflexive defense of suicide bombers and its visits, the condolence calls that it pays on the families of Palestinians who've blown themselves up? It's a brutal, inexcusable act. It was a huge miscalculation. It robbed the Palestinians of any support that they might have had. And is greatly responsible and gave Ariel Sharon an opening to crush them, especially after 9/11, with the open support of the Bush administration. So clearly, it was both morally indefensible and, as a tactic, extremely stupid.
Let me just pick up on one other point that the caller made, and I want to go on to some other folks, and that is the degree to which Yasser Arafat is directly responsible for directing, ordered, you know, whatever kind of language you want to use, the violence that we have seen.
The great unanswered question, of course, is just how much a question that's been raised for the last 3 years is how much control Arafat has over this. You know, one can look at empirical evidence and make a few statements, I think. One is that at the very beginning of the Intifada, the anger on the streets, especially that provoked by the killings by Israeli troops of dozens of kids who were throwing rocks, no question this happened. We know it as a fact. Israel shoots down children, claiming that rocks are potential lethal weapons. In my mind, equally indefensible. At any rate, Hamas and Islamic Jihad at that point were gaining popularity on the streets as soon as this kind of wave of violence. In the first few days, Arafat, I think it's pretty clear, sensed that he was losing popular support, that Fatah was seen as, you know, perhaps not strong enough, not militant enough, made a decision fairly early on that Fatah was going to take back control of the streets, but definitely gave the green light to militarize the Intifada, to start sniper attacks, to start killing settlers. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades carry these actions. This is the armed wing of Fatah. All this was going on with Arafat's support. I mean, to say that it wasn't is to just deny the fact that Fatah is Arafat. Arafat is, you know, the chairman of Fatah. The Fatah fighters were carrying out killings. It's that simple. But I think at some point the movement sort of got away from him. It became this monster that he created a monster, and then at some point it simply became too difficult for him to. It gained its own momentum, and Arafat found himself with less and less power to stop it. So I believe he started it, but then couldn't stop it.
All right. Next caller is in Philo, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Could you talk about the settlement situation there, the settlement movement? I mean, these are occupied territories, and there are Jewish settlements built in the occupied territories, and then the Israeli army has to protect those settlements, and that's part of the problem here, among many of the problems here. And also, in conjunction with that, the American Zionist movement, which I think is in conjunction with that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
I think that the Mitchell report in 2001, former Senator George Mitchell's authoritative report on the Intifada said that the settlements are the biggest single issue preventing any kind of peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. Picked up the New York Times today and saw that in spite of all of the pressures, all of the Palestinian outrage over the existence of these settlements, American objections, today the Israeli government announced it was moving ahead and building 600 more units in three settlements in the West Bank. It's inexplicable to me. It's the settlements are already so provocative that to continue to expand them, as Ariel Sharon is doing, just makes any hope for a peace deal just impossible. And so I think that it's a huge, huge problem. But I don't think that Ariel Sharon is serious about dealing with it. I think that if anything, he wants to go down in history as a prime minister who cemented the hold of the Jewish people over the occupied territories rather than somebody who withdrew from them. And that's fundamentally what this conflict is about.
The other question had to do with perhaps the degree to which American supporters of Israel, are they part of the problem?
Yeah, I think they're part of the problem. I mean, I guess I don't know how well. It's a very strong and vocal group, and I don't know to what extent George Bush listens to them, or to what extent, to how much that plays into his decision making, and how much the fact that there seems to be a natural, he seems very simpatico with Ariel Sharon, and has pretty much given Sharon a long leash and let him do basically whatever he wants, short of killing Arafat. So I think to some extent the Zionist movement, I don't want to belabor this too long, but Zionism, you can be a Zionist and not be in favor of occupying the territories, you know. So let's be careful about defining our terms when we talk about American Zionists. Are we talking about people who support the State of Israel? Are we talking about people who support, you know, the conquest of Judea and Samaria, the occupied territories?
All right, let's go to Champaign for another caller here, line two. Hello.
Hi. I have a few questions, but your last comment about American Zionists being part of the problem, if you want to bring that up, you could also just as well say that the Arab states that support Hamas are part of the problem. But leaving that aside, I agree that the roadmap has some major problems, and the problems have to do, as you say, with the settlements and also the requirement to dismantle the terrorist organizations, Hamas and so forth. A ceasefire isn't dismantling, and a ceasefire certainly did not stop the suicide bombers. So, I mean, though you put the blame on for breaking the ceasefire on Israel, the ceasefire wasn't the roadmap. The roadmap required something else. So I think there's a need to really look at what it is we're talking about. We're talking about an ongoing war where there are certain groups, such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad, that say we want to wipe out the Strait of Israel and kill all Jews. And they attempt to do it in whatever way they can. Those in Gaza can't because, for the most part, they're stopped from moving into Israel proper. I'll get off. I just want to bring up one other point, and then I'll hear your response. I'd like you to explore, if you would, if you've read it, the Dershowitz's book about the case for Israel. If you haven't read it, just beg off.
Okay. I haven't read it yet because it just came out while I've been on this U.S. tour, and I just haven't had like a minute to sit down and read anything. But I look forward to reading it. The answer to your first question about Hamas and Islamic Jihad is, it's a really good question, and it just keeps coming up in all of my talks. Why doesn't the Palestinian Authority crack down? Why don't they fulfill their end of the road of their obligations and carry out these massive arrests and seizure of weapons? The answers to those questions are, well, first of all, I'm not positive that the Palestinian Authority at the moment has the capacity to do it. The security forces have the capacity to do that. Part of that is Arafat's problem, you know, the fact that Arafat controls half the security forces. And they're loyal to him. The security forces are divided and chaotic, and they have several different commanders, and it's a mess. So that's the first problem. Ability. Second of all, I would say will. The general feeling among the Palestinian Authority leaders is that they don't trust Ariel Sharon. They're not going to crack down on these groups and almost certainly provoke you know, massive unrest in the streets, because remember, these groups are very popular. They'll be shooting back. There'll be blood spilled. Palestinians will die. The Palestinian Authority leaders that I've talked to say, why should we do this when we don't have any guarantee from Sharon that, you know, that there's going to be any reward for this kind of civil war that we're provoking in our own society? There's such distrust of Ariel Sharon that they're not willing to make that step. And that's the reason that the roadmap has been doomed, because neither side trusts the other. And the U.S. has not been there to forcefully say, you know, to act as a referee. So you end up just with both sides trading accusations, distrusting each other, hating each other. And, you know, Sharon keeps building the settlements. The Palestinian Authority refuses to take action against Hamas. And it goes on and on.
Yes, but if I could just add, at least the Al-Aqsa Brigade is his, and supposedly he has control over them, and yet he doesn't crack down on them either.
Yeah, well, the Al-Aqsa Brigade, from what I've been hearing from European diplomats, is that they may be even more out of control than Hamas and Islamic Jihad. I mean, I don't believe that the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades even agreed to a ceasefire with Abbas. I believe it was just Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So they're a wild card in all this, and it's not that easy to just move in and crack down on these groups. They're deeply embedded in Palestinian society. They have huge support. The Palestinian Authority is weak. It's not particularly popular. It's very unpopular, and they're not getting any signs from Israel that there's going to be any reward at the end of it. So all of this is working to, you know, prevent this kind of massive crackdown that the Americans and the Israelis are demanding.
We have just about 5 minutes. I'd like to try and include at least one other caller. Next in line is Gibson City, so we'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yes, I just want to say that I was in the West Bank in Israel for a month this summer as part of Christian Peacemaker Team, and we're a nonviolent presence in Hebron. We do have an apartment there. People live there full time, and we document human rights violations. And one of the things we do is, I wasn't there while there was school in progress, but we do assist children going to school. And I'm just a common everyday person. I'm not, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is two groups to me there. There's the group. And it's not an Israeli-Palestinian thing. It's the group that wants to settle it by violence, and they don't want to make any they want to have it their way. And I see, and I've seen and talked to peacemakers on both sides that want to settle it peacefully. And I guess one of my heroes over there is Rabbi Eric Escherman, who is head of Rabbis for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's kind of interesting about talking about a Zionist, and he considers them a Zionist, but he also is very devout Jew and considers what they're doing to the Palestinians is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the right way of obtaining or maintaining a Palestinian state. And I so agree with him. And I also know a lady that has started a school, it's like a summer camp for children, and she has a psychologist and a couple teachers. And what she does with these children is help them cope with the traumatic things they've gone through, and also teaching them nonviolence. And I guess that gives me hope. I've met most people on both sides that I just really, truly admire, and I would say there is for me as a Christian, there's a Christian love there that I just, you know, these people are against all these odds, and I think the powers and principalities that be are not going to be the ones that settle it. And I guess my question is, We are, if my last figures are correct, we are giving or sending over or guaranteeing Israel $2.7 billion, not million, but billion, of aid, and most of this is military aid. And I guess, would that be a point of starting? We as U.S. citizens, you know, complaining and asking and our government to be more responsible about this money. And then I'll say goodbye.
Okay. Well, now we have got a couple minutes left, so you can pick up on anything the caller said. Or
yeah, I think there are little small rays of hope here and there. The Rabbis for Human Rights is an interesting group, and I receive their newsletters. And I mean, it's quite interesting to have a Jewish group like that, a religious group, keeping tabs on what it views as Israeli human rights abuses, and in the West Bank. So they have a sort of a sense of authenticity about them. And the question about American aid. Well, you know, the United States has in the past used the leverage of aid. To try to reform Israeli policy. In the early 1990s, they withdrew money from these loan guarantees to Israel. For every dollar that was spent in the occupied territories, the U.S. took away $1 of these loan guarantees. And it's threatening to do it again this time around as Sharon continues to build a fence and continues to expand these settlements in defiance of the entire world. This particular American administration just doesn't seem to be willing to push too hard. They just don't want to crack the whip, and they're unwilling to alienate Sharon or alienate the pro-Israel camp here to do anything beyond a couple of mild words of rebuke. And I think it's a problem. I think this government has to face up to what the Sharon government is doing there and how antithetical to peace his policies are. And maybe use money as a leverage, as a cudgel, in a way that it hasn't been willing to do so in the past.
We're going to have to stop. We've used the time and discuss the general issue, perhaps not given very much attention to the book. But if people are interested in reading some of Joshua Hammer's writing, of course, you can see it in Newsweek, but some of his reporting and some of his experiences over the past couple of years, you can look for his book, A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place, and it's published by the Free Press. It's out now. Joshua Hammer is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Great. You're welcome.
We appreciate it.
Interesting.